It's February 19th, 2023, and welcome to episode 264 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know. Will I ever find my way back to Oz?
Will I ever... Here's Here is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and some other things that we will discover along the way. I am Paul Hegstrom, near Boston. I am joined by two other retro computing enthusiasts, Quinn Dungy in British Columbia.
Hello. It is a beautiful day here in British Columbia.
And also joining us is Carrington Vanston in Toronto.
I am also a beautiful day.
Or Ontario.
That's true, yes. Ah, Ontario, Toronto.
Yeah.
Earth, comma, yeah. Here.
If people are wondering, like, I don't have a city because, like, I live literally in the middle of nowhere, so there's no large city with which I can associate my position, so it's just easier to say.
We assume you live there by court order.
Well, possibly. There might be, when you add up all of the restraining orders, the Venn diagram of them.
It's the only place it doesn't overlap.
That's right. Pushes me way out in the middle of nowhere, so it's, yeah, kind of a problem, but making it work.
Excellent. All right. So here we are. We are on episode 264. We have kind of weekly been following the idea that we would talk about the year that relates to the episode number.
How do you spell weekly?
1964. Yes. Well, I was spelling it with an A.
I thought yes. So. Okay, good.
Yeah, but we've been our fortnightly podcast has been coming out roughly monthly for a while. But anyway, so 1964 is the year. A huge amount of stuff happened. We last time we were noting that 1963, everybody sort of took a break. But and yet I'm not sure that how well prepared we are for this. So we may stretch this out over a couple of episodes, because also Michael could not be here, but is very enthusiastic about the year 1964 for some reason. So the first thing I found when I searched was that this was 1964 was when the term double bucky was coined. Do you guys know the double bucky?
No, I've never heard of this.
Double bucky. That's when you press two modifier keys.
It is. Yeah, this is the first time I had ever heard about this. It seemed like it was touted as like a
because modifier keys are buckies, which is from Nick Worth, right?
Yes.
Yeah, see?
Yep. That's amazing.
I know some things.
I have never heard of any of this. I feel like you're all making this up. This is the Sam Coupe of computer jargon, because conspiracy.
Wait,
I've never heard of any of this.
His nickname, for whatever reason, was Bucky. And so, and that from him we get Buckies as modifier keys, like Control or whatever. And so the most famous one would be a Control-Alt-Delete would be a double Bucky.
Because two modifiers at once.
Did he invent the concept of a modifier?
Maybe he just had to reset his computer a bunch of times. I don't know. We're at the extent of the trivia I know. I think it's amazing I knew.
I am pretty impressed.
Question me anything. We just accept that I knew a thing.
No follow-up questions.
Having come up with Perfect. Nick Worth is completely astounding.
Yeah, that was a good poll.
Well, he's the guy who... He's the Pascal guy. He made Pascal.
Ah.
That's why I know him.
I mean, if he did invent the modifier key, the concept of that, which we will say he did until someone emails us otherwise, that's pretty amazing. Like, someone had to invent that idea, right? And when you think that it doubles the number of keys on the keyboard instantly, like, that's sort of amazing.
Yeah, he did not invent that. That would have come from, like, the shift key, I think.
I guess, yeah. I suppose that came from typewriters. Yeah, yeah, I suppose typewriters.
I think he just referred to them as modifiers or whatever, buckies. But then coined the term a double bucky. Like, I've never heard it as like press a single bucky. It's just like do a double bucky, which is two modifiers are needed for this. This is a crazy key combination. We got to type a double bucky.
That's neat.
I also came across the a parody of a very fine song called Rubber Ducky, which was published in the Sesame Street songbook that goes,
I know that
Double
song.
Bucky, you're the one.
That's pretty funny.
I know. You make my keyboard lots of fun. Let's see.
I will say that in modern applications, this has gotten way out of hand. Like in Final Cut Pro one of the other applications I use, the export is like three or four modifiers. It's like all the ones in the lower left corner of the Mac keyboard. You hit all of them at once with save. I don't even know which one it is because I've just got this like muscle memory claw now that like can mash the correct keys, but it's ridiculous. Like you look at the menu item and it's this whole row of little symbols that you're supposed to push. It's
maybe somebody misread it. Like read it as control all. It's like, oh, I see. Like, press control all F.
Yeah. Okay. It's like a quadruple Bucky or something.
I feel like being Phantom of the Opera when you do that, though. You're just like, oh, yes, I am saving. Press all the keys on the R. I don't know why Phantom of the Opera became a pirate, but whatever.
Yeah, sure. Thinking about 3D printing some sort of like thing that's the right shape that can just mash all those keys at once.
Yeah.
I don't have to remember what the combination is.
That seems, I really like that sort of indirect typing idea. There was, at some time, you know, a year ago or something like that, we had an eBay auction for a thing that you would put over top of your, I guess it's over top of your Apple II, that would like type for you, that would like, it had little pistons that would push the keys down.
Yeah, wasn't that to work around some sort of law against computerized stock trading or something? So they had this robot that would do the thing for them because it was physically typing, so it bypassed the law. It was something like that. It was something hilariously sketchy.
I like it. I don't know if it's true, but I want it to be.
Yeah, there was some story about why they did that. It was something like that, but we'll have to listen to our own show. I know we talked about it. Anyway.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, there's no chance we'll remember anything more than three shows back. All right, let's see. So the other thing, another thing that happened was apparently BASIC. Was introduced
really
in 1964.
Oh, I didn't think it was for a couple more years later. That's interesting.
I didn't know it was that early either.
Yeah,
I thought it was a lot later. I thought that was like a 70s thing.
100%. I thought it was early 70s.
Yep. So here is the Wikipedia article.
Ah, well then.
You know, checking the box. I think it was. It came actually. It was sort of the. Successor to a couple of things. One was called DARSIMCO, the Dartmouth Simplified Code. Another one was called DOPE, Dartmouth Oversimplified Programming Experiment. I kind of wish it. I wish that it had turned in. I wish DOPE had won. But anyway,
BASIC is one of the great backronyms of the world, though I have to say, like that. That's pretty tortured, but also pretty great.
Yeah,
I think we. I think we landed on a good one there.
There's a bunch of stuff that happened right in this mid-1960s area that is really hard to pin down to a year. I mean, I think we've had that problem before where, you know, something was announced and then it shipped to the first commercial customer and all of that's like three different years. So the IBM System 360 was announced, but maybe it was first delivered in 1965, so maybe we'll postpone that until next time when
I'd call
Michael
that a
can tell us something about it. Yeah. Saber. That was something that came up.
We talked about Saber before, though.
Oh, the flight reservation system?
Yeah.
That Saber?
Yeah.
Or the Buffalo hockey team.
I didn't know it was that early. That's super early. I didn't realize that.
Yeah. It was originally American Airlines, and they, you know, I think 1964 was when they fully switched over. So it had existed for a couple of years before that, but essentially they were just having scaling problems.
Okay, that's so early. I had no idea Sabre goes back that far. It's a really interesting example of gatekeeping of data. Like it's that the Sabre system basically created the industry of travel agents, right? Because the entire business model of the travel agent was that they had access to this database and you didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And because I'm sure we all remember booking flights, you know, in the 80s, you'd go down to the travel agency, you know, or the motor club or wherever, and you'd sit across a desk from a person who had a Sabre terminal on their desk, and they would say, how about at 11 a.m. on the 17th? And you'd be like, no, that's too early. How about 11:45? And you'd be like, maybe. Is that direct? No. And you'd go back and forth like this, and it was the stupidest interaction ever. And then I guess it was Expedia or whoever did that first was just like, hey, we can put a web front end on this, and then eliminated an entire industry overnight, which kind of makes me happy. I'm sad for all the travel agents that lost their jobs, but also it kind of makes me happy because gatekeeping of data is terrible.
Weirdly, I heard that or read that travel agents is one of the things that is booming. Like it's done this massive upswing in a resurgence of a thing. I'm like, really? I thought it'd be like gone forever.
Yeah.
Why would there be so many travel agents now? Like that seems crazy to me. I hate it. I hate it when I'm across the counter from somebody and they get to look at the bits and then they will tell me little parts of what the, I was like, oh, this is terrible.
Just let me look at your screen. Like at all point.
I had to send a bunch of things. In fact, we were talking last episode. I have a little game out. So I've been mailing that out. And so I have to go up to Canada Post. So I'm mailing this. And then they'll look down and say, well, the cheapest option is this. I'm like, is it cheapest of five? Is it 50 cents cheaper than the one that has tracking? Like, just turn the screen around. And like, oh, it's so frustrating.
Yeah. I wonder if travel agents came back for a lot of the reasons that other disciplines like that have come back, which is that now we have so much information that it's gotten too complicated. So now if you want to book like a really interesting trip, like I want to go, you know, spelunking in Borneo or whatever, that's really hard for you to book online because there's so much information. You don't know which tour companies are good and bad, and you don't know which airlines are crooked, and so you don't know which vaccinations you need. So now there's this market for someone who can concierge this whole experience on your behalf kind of thing, as opposed to just booking flights, which you can do by yourself. That might be why.
Also, Mark in the chat asked, this is sort of in relation to the double Bucky. He wanted to check to make sure that we were aware of, or ask if we were aware of the Shift Happens book, a book about keywords.
I'm not aware.
I know Shift Happens the game.
Well, when I searched for it first, it was actually some sort of like, new agey self-help book. So apparently it's a well-used or often used title. But this one is Shift Happens, subtitle, A Book About Keyboards, to separate it from the other ones.
Okay.
Covering 150 years from early typewriters to the pixelated keyboards in our pockets. Seems cool. And also relates to the gift idea. So even better. All right, let's see. So other things that are mentioned in 1964 are the ASR33 teletype.
That's a big thing.
Machine. Yes. And the other thing that showed up was the CDC 6600 supercomputer, generally considered to be the first successful supercomputer. So successful is the thing that makes it this one.
It also depends on how you define supercomputer. It's like,
and successful.
But also, like, sometimes a supercomputer is like, oh, this combines 1,000 computers, or this combines 10 computers. Like, how super was 64?
For a little while there was a technical definition of supercomputer. Like, it had to have some number of gigaflops, or it had to exceed, like, consumer machines by some amount. Like, there was a technical definition of it. I think that's gone away, though, because it's just now there's just so much variation and everything. But things have gotten harder to measure and everything so fast that I don't think it has any meaning anymore. But
yeah, it's interesting because the CDC 6600 is, I think, a major player, like a big deal computer that I feel like I only came up, like I was only aware of it like 3 months ago or something. That it somehow never crossed my field of vision until somewhat recently.
I feel that way about all of Control Data Corporation, honestly. Mm-hmm. Like, it was a big deal for like 10 years there in the 60s and 70s, but was not on the radar, I think, of home hobbyists at all. Like, unless you were a defense contractor, you probably never had any of their flyers handed to you, so you didn't know they existed. But it was, they were.
Yeah, I knew them enough to know their logo, the cool little
C. It's very nice.
Yeah.
And you'd see that on mugs and stuff of people on their steel desks and things. You know you're in trouble if you're in front of somebody who's got one of those mugs. But completely ran under or over my radar.
Yeah.
Right.
I think to hold one of those mugs, I think you had to be wearing a lab coat. I think that was
it comes with the mug
requirement.
Yeah. Want some coffee? Yeah, put it.
So I grew up in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area, and I think CDC is actually sort of based around there.
Ooh. I think it may also be the case that it's one of those companies that got merged into someone else fairly early on in the consolidation of supercomputing, because like by the early 90s, it was just Cray, and then Cray got bought by SGI, and then that was kind of it for the whole industry pretty much. So CDC might have been the first one to get bought, and so that's why they went away so quickly from the collective consciousness, maybe.
Could be.
Like I don't know this for a fact, but maybe Cray bought them in the 70s or something.
And I think the CDC 6600 was designed by Seymour Cray. I mean, so it's a it has a Cray history.
Cool.
It's Cray Cray.
God. I'm off the show. That's it. I'm out. This isn't worth it.
Never was.
Oh, that was physically painful.
All right. Yeah, so that was a very cursory overview of things that happened in 1964. Some of the stuff I would sort of like, for some of these supercomputers, I would kind of like to try to spin up like SimH or Hercules to run to try them. I have done that with Hercules, I think, once. And it was interesting, but I've forgotten all of it, and, you know, it's complicated.
I played a little bit with Cray's when I worked at SGI, because I was there just at the very tail end after the acquisition, but before they shut down the division. And the whole experience is very strange. Like, it wasn't as cool as I expected, because it's very alien. It's a completely different computing model, and like the operating system is like nothing you've seen. And unless you have a specific application, it's like, hey, I've got this terabyte database of numbers that I need to crunch, and it used to take a month and now it takes a week. This is amazing. Unless you have that to kind of throw at it, you don't really understand. It doesn't seem cool. Like, it just seems like this strange, complicated thing that you don't know how to make it do anything.
I was, I've probably mentioned this, you know, every single time this comes up, but the thing that astounded me was just the volume of output it spits out when it boots. I mean, it's like, you know, a huge stack of paper if it was actually being printed. I mean, it's unbelievable. So
yeah, those machines were very log heavy, that's for sure. I mean, so is any Unix machine. If you enable all the logging, like a Linux, even a Linux machine, or even your Mac OS, if you enable all the full logging, like, it's like it takes 10 gigabytes of logs just to boot. It's kind of nuts. Yeah, it's mostly off by default nowadays, but it's all still in there.
Mm-hmm. And it is kind of funny. I do marvel sometimes at the ability you can kind of get to, even though everything is flying by, it can still kind of see the important parts as they fly by. And it's like, oh, I see what happened there. Yeah. You know? But yeah, that happens only sometimes. And for a while I had one of the servers I was maintaining, you know, mail me the logs every morning. And then it quickly became clear that I hadn't read them in like a year and a half. I just delete them as they come. So it's like, all right, well, this is not worth doing.
Yeah, I mean, log overload is a big problem, even on modern computing. Like a lot of, especially like enterprise computing, again, the servers are very, very log heavy. And so there's a whole industry of logging filtering tools to try and make that logging usable, because of course when it's gigabytes of text scrolling by, it's useless. You have to be able to narrow it down to help with a particular problem that you're trying to solve. So you have to have elaborate tools that can filter and sort and search logs, and it was the same in game development, because logging of course is the last resort debugging tool, right? So a lot of times with console development, where you're talking to this foreign box over a wire, you can't step through code or see what it's doing at certain critical moments, like during startup and so on, times when there's no ability to connect a debugger, then now you have to use logging. So we spent a lot of time writing log filtering tools and log formatting and, you know, color coding logs and all this kind of stuff, because otherwise the data is just overwhelming.
Brandon in the chat said that the Living Computer Museum used to have a CDC 6600 offshoot that you could get a remote login to, and it was pretty fun to play with.
Oh, that's cool.
Including a very capable basic version that could invert a 32 by 32 matrix with one command. So
neat. Does anyone know what the operating system would have been there? Did they just have their own CDC OS of some sort, or I wonder what that would have run? VMS or something?
I think not. In fact, I think there are probably people out there cringing at the thought.
Oh, like 1,000 people have flipped their tables already in this episode. Like,
yeah. Yes, but I don't know what the operating system is. We did so a few times ago. We talked about somebody who's kind of like, I think coming to this from sort of where we were, sort of trying to explore using a CD. It's a emulated CDC 6600 operating system, kind of like working through how to make it go and blogging as the project continued.
I'm super glad I just Googled this because it has the coolest name for an operating system ever. Mm. The operating system was called Kronos.
Oh yeah.
Yes.
Kronos. Yeah. There was an alternative one called Scope, all caps. I don't know what that stands for, but yeah, Kronos. So I didn't know this either. It's a 60-bit processor at 10 megahertz.
60.
So yeah, they went wide and shallow with that architecture. Yeah. 60 bits, but not very fast. Yeah. So there you go.
Cool.
Kronos.
Cool. Yes.
Love it.
I think maybe that by itself would add another level to wanting to explore this, because you want to be a Kronos expert.
Yeah, Kronos with a K, no less.
Yeah.
Makes it awesome.
Yeah, well, I pronounced it with a K. Could you not tell? Okay. Yeah. So next time is 1965 and all the stuff that we didn't actually talk about 1964, I suppose. But there's a couple of feedback items that we could talk about. So Bob wrote over email to tell us about the Picomite. So I think we've talked a couple of times about the Micromite, and I think there's also a what is it called? Like a Maximite? Yes, it is a Maximite, in fact. Which is, so the Micromite, as I understand it, was actually just sort of like a little microcontroller that has BASIC on it, you know, so you can sort of, if you plug it into a surrounding environment, it will provide you BASIC. And this is kind of a similar thing for the Pico, the Raspberry Pi Pico. So if you have a Pico, you can put this on it and it will sort of boot into BASIC and be a little BASIC machine. And it's largely compatible with the Micromite. So it runs MM BASIC, which is presumably something Mite BASIC.
I was just going to say, I could see this being really useful for like home automation projects and stuff. Like BASIC, BASIC is a really great language for those kind of quick and dirty, like if then that sorts of projects. I mean, there's other stuff that's doing that too. Like there's versions of Python and stuff that people use for that type of thing. But BASIC would be a fun choice for a little home automation and things that you would do with an Arduino, right? Because like Arduino has its little simplified C language that it uses. But now that we're talking about it, BASIC seems like a better choice than that, honestly, than the Arduino language, which is kind of clunky because it's literally just a C compiler with a massive pile of macros built into header files, so you can turn pins on and off on the on the board and stuff. But BASIC would be way more fun.
Yeah, or maybe even better, dope.
Yes. Still trying to make dope happen, Paul.
I was hooked on dope.
Yep. I definitely know that. I've had this experience where if there's some little short little programming thing I need to do, like I just need to compute something that's not quite doable on a calculator, I have occasionally just started up an Apple II emulator and typed a couple of AppleSoft lines to figure it out because that's the fastest. You know, among the Raspberry Pi family of products, the Pico is like one of the only ones you can get at the moment. I think you can get them and they're pretty cheap. So it's a pretty easy thing to do. And it has all the support stuff around it. If you wire it up, it can show you its own screen and take input and that sort of thing. But otherwise, I think you can just do it over the terminal, over the serial.
Cool. There used to be this thing called the BASIC stamp. It was one of like the original like Arduino type boards, and it was built around BASIC. And that was its whole modus operandi, was to be an Arduino like thing. Before Arduino existed, and it was all based on BASIC, you could buy them in Radio Shack, which was kind of cool. One of the last cool things that Radio Shack sold. And they went away. I don't really know why. I don't know what I don't know what microcontroller was on it. Maybe I think, oh, you know what? I think it was propeller based, and that was part of the problem. The propeller microcontrollers went away. So that might've been part of why, but I always thought that was a great idea for a thing, just a little board that you can plug in and turn on LEDs or turn on your furnace or whatever, and just program it all with BASIC.
I may have a couple of these, you know, because it seemed like a fun project, and then I never really got around to it, but it is, it's just a little thing.
Yeah, there it is. That's the one.
So, but it's true. I feel like there was, the name Propeller came up a fair amount years ago, and then it's true that I've not heard of it since, so.
Yeah, I think they stopped making them. It was a neat thing. It was a completely different architecture than other microcontrollers. Like the Arduinos are all based on the AVR microcontrollers, which are kind of a standard Harvard architecture. So there's EEPROM and RAM and ROM, and it runs a pretty standard CPU, single-threaded, to run your code. The Propeller is a completely different beast. It's like multi-threaded by design, and you start up all these little things. They call them, they have clever names for all of it, involving metaphors for helicopter blades. But you would spin up these little propellers or whatever that, so you would run like 15 microprocesses instead of a single mega process to do your job. So it was kind of like the PlayStation architecture versus the Xbox One. Instead of one really big fast CPU, it was a whole bunch of tiny slow ones. Cogs, that was it. Thank you, commenters. You have these little cogs running, and it was a neat thing, but it was, I guess, probably more difficult for most people to wrap their head around as far as how to program it. But it was sort of more powerful in the real world than AVRs are. But again, I think they lost out because it was too confusing of an architecture for people, maybe. I don't know.
Let's see. Two more feedback things. So the first of them is somebody... So Levi posted on Facebook about a video that he made. Video title is running. Can I run OpenAI chatbots on an Apple II? So it's a running ChatGPT on a 2GS is sort of the goal. I mean, he sort of walks through it, but essentially what it's doing is talking to a Raspberry Pi and funneling it through to an Apple 2GS. So quite possibly much of this is as interesting to you as any other application of this kind of channeling to a Raspberry Pi might be. I mean, like, even if that wasn't what you were trying to do, the OpenAI stuff, you could probably adapt this to whatever that is. And I think actually he didn't quite manage to get ChatGPT, but some other related kind of AI talking to it. But
so in the footage we're looking at right now, he's in a terminal program. Is this Spectrum? Is that what it's called?
Yeah, I think it was. It went by there quickly, but...
Yeah. Okay, yeah, the high-end multicolor 2GS terminal program. That's actually super cool. If anyone hasn't seen Spectrum, it's awesome. It's one of those things that came along after the BBS days were long gone, but it's the BBS program that you always wanted as a 2GS because it's full-color ANSI support. So you could have been looking at all those awesome PC BBSs all along. Someone had written this.
Yeah, so it's in a category of things that are, you know, basically channeling. I guess we were sort of talking about that last time too, like, you know, sort of channeling stuff out in the outer web through a little pipe to your old computer.
Yeah. So in other words, all the 2GS is doing is actually just acting as a terminal to talk to the Raspberry Pi, and then the Raspberry Pi is doing everything else. But still, there's something sort of neat about it.
Yeah. I mean, it is kind of cool. So like some of the stuff that the, maybe this is a little bit different, but some of the stuff that you do with like FujiNet where you fetch weather data or fetch, you know, where the International Space Station is or whatever. You could actually use that in your Apple program to do something, or, you know, like it's not, there are ways that you could use this. It wouldn't be just, relaying information that the Raspberry Pi is gathering, but actually, you know, using it to do slow computations on your 8-bit 1 megahertz machine.
Yeah, that would be the potential is there. If someone wrote like a new version of Eliza, let's say that which did exist on the Apple II, or like the animal game, you remember the animal game where you would it would ask you questions and guess which animal you were thinking of. Surprisingly clever little chatbot. You could write a version of that that behind the scenes was going out over the Raspberry Pi and submitting requests to ChatGPT. Like, that would be awesome. Like, that would be something that I would be impressed with a little bit more than yet another thing where someone's texting or serial porting into a Raspberry Pi and the Raspberry Pi is doing something neat. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's the potential is there to do something cool.
Yeah, and I think so. I didn't watch this all the way through, but it did seem like that was part of what Leva had in mind here was it would be that you could make something that's sort of a little bit more amazing than Eliza, you know. But yeah. I agree that I think it would be most interesting if the Apple II somewhere in the did some of its own processing on the data.
Yeah, if it was using ChatGPT as a service as opposed to just acting as a dumb terminal to a Raspberry Pi. Yeah, like we were talking before the show a little bit, how we've gotten kind of saturated with these projects, and I don't want to gatekeep anything. I love that people are doing all of this stuff, but we are a little bit saturated with projects that are ultimately, at the end of the day, just the retro computer is acting as a dumb terminal to something else, which is doing something. But if someone goes one step further, I'm all in on that. I want to see that.
Okay, the third of the three feedbacks I was going to talk about. Is that how you pluralize feedback?
Sure.
It is now. Feedsback.
Feedsback.
So Rob posted on Facebook about Retro Directory, and this it is a site, and it comes with a YouTube video introduction. And so the YouTube video introduction is, you know, tells you sort of what it is and how it works, but it is essentially a place where you can put your meetups or your museum or your whatever little gift shop or whatever it is that's sort of retro themed arcade. If you have a podcast, you can put a podcast on there. I think he's basically just hoping that this will be a good sort of like central source, and the tie-in with the map actually is a pretty cool thing. So if you're going on a trip somewhere, you can see where you're going and what's around you and who you should visit. And I think it's just pretty new at this point, and it has a bunch of stuff in it already. But there's a way to submit stuff. So if you have a thing that you want to submit, you make an account and submit it. I have no reason to think that anything bad will happen to your data. Well, it is sort of, collecting logins or whatever, but I think it's a neat project. And it's only going to work if people contribute to it, really. I mean, like it's being sort of crowdsourced.
That's kind of cool. So, I figured I'd open up and just see what it suggested for around me. And it's only really has the one entry for Toronto, but it's a place called ANC Games, which is a very small shop but is absolutely one of the go-to places if you're in the GTA and you want to pick up retro gaming things. Like if you wanted a cart or a system for like an old, like you say, you're looking to pick up an Intellivision cartridge or whatever, like that is the place you would go in Toronto. And it's not hugely known. So well done. That's if somebody was coming to Toronto and was super into retro things, it's one of the places I would recommend. So I dig it so far. I will think of other places and maybe add them in.
Yeah, I absolutely love this idea. What I also looked it up for myself, and it's a wide range of things which I really like. So like in Vancouver, they've got the Capital City Arcade, which is a retro arcade, but also the Chilliwack Retro Computing Club, which is just a computing club. So it's really spanning the range of things that children of the 80s might want to do, which is awesome.
Yeah, and if you have a YouTube channel, you can list your YouTube channel. If you have a podcast, you can list your podcast, and allegedly you can claim your podcast, which, look at that.
Those things I find less helpful or interesting. I'd want to know, I'm visiting Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
What would be of interest to someone like me or a listener to the show? Like the fact that there's a podcast in Pittsburgh, that's a retro thing. That's fine, but that's not an in Pittsburgh thing. That's a broadcasting thing.
Right.
I'm much more interested in, where's an arcade I could go to, or pick up retro things, or view retro things, or a neat retro computer museum, or something like that.
Yeah.
But hopefully you can filter for the stuff and go, I don't want to see YouTube channels that happen to be from that city, but I do want to see arcades. Yep. Neat.
Yeah, and it's that broad base that really appeals to me. Like, if you're a pinball person like me, there are a bunch of pinball locator apps, but I also want to see retro arcades, and I also want to go to a store that sells in television cartridges. So, yeah, to have all of that in one place, because there's no unified directory for a lot of that other stuff. I don't know of a directory of retro game stores, for example, or computer clubs.
Yeah.
So to be able to say, oh, I'm going to Vancouver, I can go buy some games and also play pinball at this other place. That's super cool.
This I would find very helpful for road trips. Absolutely. So I will contribute things. I would like this to be full of stuff. Cool.
Yeah, everyone go in here and put in your stuff, please. So we can
put your home addresses. We'll come by and talk computers. Yeah. Play your stuff.
Stuff like this, always there's always a tipping point for it. Like, once enough data gets into it that it becomes everybody's go-to, then it just sort of explodes and it becomes the standard, you know. So it always takes effort to get these things over that tipping point when there's crowdsourced data.
And it's got a good name, Retro Directory, and then it's just retro.directory. Yeah. So that's good. It's easy to remember. So it's well implemented. I like it. I dig it. I say yes.
Yeah, and I think a fair amount of effort went in, I'm sure, at the front end to just populate it with as many things as were available. So
yeah, and the UI is actually really nice. You can just pan around the map and you can filter based on like auctions and clubs and arcades, and
that is cool, because I'm just like scrolling around, happen to land on Las Vegas. Like, I would go to Las Vegas, but whatever. Mm-hmm. But you see, okay, Pinball Hall of Fame, I knew about that, but I didn't know that not too far from there is the Back to the 80s Cafe. Like, that's probably where I'd want to then pop over again. Like, so yeah, this appeals to me. I want to subscribe to this newsletter.
Yeah.
Yeah, retro themed cafes, that's a cool thing to add. Their data is definitely light. Like, I just went over to Denver where there's multiple super awesome retro arcades and none are listed. So we definitely got the Up-Down Arcade in Kansas City.
Yep.
Yeah, we've been there.
The Up-Down is there.
That place is awesome.
Anyway, yeah, so the retro directory, good idea. Let's hope that takes off. Anyway, that was the last of the feedback that I wanted to talk about. So now we can turn to items of interest in news, and Carrington has the first of our entertainment news.
We may have talked about it before, but it's a movie about Tetris, not the game, but the making of the game and bringing it to America, land of the Tetris freedom, and eagles and stuff and whatever. And so I think it was supposed to come out a few years ago. It's been development forever, and I thought it was just dead. Nope. Having a premiere in a couple of weeks, and it's going to be on Apple TV Plus. And the neat thing about this movie is, you think if I was making a movie about Tetris, it would be like a funny joke movie or whatever, and Tetris comes to life and attacks people. No, this is like a hardcore drama about how will we wrestle Tetris from the Soviets and release it to the world or whatever. And you watch the trailer, and it looks really interesting, but it's like lots of very dramatic music playing, and somebody's got to bet his whole house on meeting the Soviets and getting the guy who made it to understand how it's got to be released to freedom or something. I don't know. It looks kind of fun. So I will certainly watch it. And it's neat. It's Tetris. It's kind of retro. It's not really computers, but I've played it on many computers. And I guess in the trailer it talks about how we're going to show you this new thing. It's called the Game Boy. Like, oh, it'll change all. Release it with that. Anyway, it's taking itself very seriously. But it does look fun. So I would watch it. I suspect people that are interested in the retro directory might want to watch it as well. So we have a link to an article about it on Retro Dodo. And you can watch the trailer. It's really excited about its own movie.
Yeah.
I would say take this with a giant grain of salt, because there are few stories in video game history as controversial as the story of Tetris, and it depends very much on who's telling the story and what their agenda is. I assume this is probably told from Pajitnov's point of view, and his point of view on how everything went down is very different than many other people who were involved in the development and distribution of Tetris. So I'm not going to take any sides, but let's just say there's a lot of very different versions of events that happened, and it's probably safe to say this is so heavily dramatized that it's just straight up
fiction, none of them
at this point.
Yes.
Yeah.
So anyway, Tetris. I honestly thought this movie was never coming out, because it was supposed to come out, I think, at least 2 or 3 years ago.
And if I ever knew, I totally forgot. I mean, like, so this kind of caught me by surprise, but it's like a, you know, Le Carre movie or something. You know, it's just a total, you know, Cold War espionage.
Yes. Trailer makes it look very much in the vein of a spy thriller, just about a video game. And a mustache, apparently.
Yeah.
Excellent mustache.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing how it is.
Soundtracks are going to get into your head for days.
Yeah.
I wonder if the side of the screen is just going to have a long, skinny hole in it. And the whole movie just waiting
for one frame to finally use that, and then it fades to black.
Yeah.
Okay, so I had, rather than pick a news thing, I just thought I would talk a bit about the Naboo. Because I think
Naboo. That came up. Behind the scenes, we've all been discussing the Naboo quite a bit.
Yeah.
Yes. The hot topic.
Yeah, so it's interesting. So I think we mentioned it last time and didn't fully understand, you know, what the deal was. I now have one. So it's basically what I think, you know. We were going to ask Carrington. Have you ever? Do you know this thing?
Nope.
Have you ever heard
of
this thing?
Never, ever, 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 ever.
Huh.
So it's Canadian, but neither of the two Canadians on the show have heard of this thing, which is very strange. So. I had wondered if maybe it was an East Coast thing, because in the 80s, the two sides of Canada really didn't talk to each other very much. Like I was saying, unless somebody like called you and told you about it, or it happened to be in a magazine, you wouldn't know. So there's other Canadian computers I'd never heard of because they were from Ontario. So I wondered if that was the case with this one, but Carrington hasn't heard of it either.
Nope.
So perhaps not. But it was apparently pretty big because they made a lot of them.
We've seen that picture of the skid of the one guy who's got 800 million of these things.
Yeah.
Like I'm not sure how many actually made it out, and maybe they just got all stuck on this pallet. You know. So there's a I don't know the story
boxes.
Of how this was found. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's
Oh, and didn't you calculate it, Paul? You said like just looking at the one section we can see here. How many were in this?
Yes, it's something like 684 or something like that, or I don't know. No, it was probably 864. It was close to
864 computers and boxes in his backyard. Like, it's crazy, man.
Yeah.
That photo is amazing. Like, where did they all come from? Yeah. All new in box.
Yeah.
Is the story that this guy is like a relative of the guy who started the company or something?
Well, I don't know. So this there's a company called Pell Mill LLC that is selling them both direct on their site, and they have an eBay site. And I don't know what the connection of that person is, although I mean I think reportedly from people who have talked to him, he's, you know, a nice guy or whatever, but there's another person, DJ Suarez, I think. I don't know how you pronounce his name, but it's Sures, and his father, I think, if I remember the story right, was one of the like sort of engineers at Naboo. So there is a kind of a family connection, and DJ Suarez is the one who's kind of done a lot of recent promotion, you know, getting Shures. Okay, apparently it's pronounced DJ Shures. Having done a lot of YouTube videos, and I had actually his page up here, I think. So Naboo.ca is all Shures stuff, and you know, so there's I don't know, it seems like that's just the current obsession, and it's going forward very quickly.
You want to summarize this thing for people who don't know what anything about what it is?
Yeah, so they are a Z80 machine. They were from, I think it was like 1984 or something like that, and they connected to the cable network,
or hoped to anyway.
So they were machines that didn't have internal storage, and the programs were sent around a little bit like CFAX maybe or something like that.
Like we talked about that before, like things that would stream stuff to your computer, like, and so like you're grabbing your software over the air or whatever, but in this case over the cable modem.
Right, but it was still kind of unidirectional. You know, it would send. You would just sort of wait in a loop for the data that you want to come by. You know, eventually you would get the menu program, and it would then run the menu program. Suddenly a bunch of these were found new in box, and then, you know, so and sold for relatively cheap. So people got pretty excited about them because they're an actual 1980s computer that you can get kind of with the 1980s air in the box, you know, that kind of thing.
For what is it? $60, I think. Yeah,
they were selling pretty cheap. And I think the other reason they've taken off so much is that they're shockingly good. So like Blake pointed out, that hardware-wise, it's basically a ColecoVision, which is a good thing. Like it's got the the TMS 9980 or whatever graphics chip in it, and it's pretty speedy. It's like 3 megahertz or something. Like, it's shockingly good for this computer that nobody's heard of and was apparently only destined to be like a set-top cable box or whatever.
Mm-hmm. So there has been a lot of very rapid community development around this, because I think, you know, people are kind of excited to find this capable machine that's like a cousin of ones they know. So it's got a Z80. If you know how to program a Z80, then you know how to do something with this. It normally had a internet adapter box, and one of the first things I was aware of was this internet adapter like program that would essentially, if you got a serial cable, it would basically pretend to be the cable network from 1984 or whatever, and so it would send the loop of programs around, and you could just start it up. If you get one of these and you either build or buy a cable that can do that, then you can send, you know, 1984 to your Naboo, and it will boot up and think it's 1984. It's pretty wild.
Yep. Amazing if this ends up being just like a scam, like somebody made a modern computer, got all this stuff, and said, I'm going to pretend this 84, tell everyone it existed, no one's heard of it. It worked for the Sam Coupe, it'll work for this, I'm going to make millions on eBay.
Yeah.
Well, it is sort of crazy. It's like looking at an alternate universe. Like, mm-hmm. Here's this machine that somehow none of us have ever heard of, but it's good looking, yep. It's powerful.
Keyboard's like, supposed to be amazing.
A screenshot of it.
Yeah, like it is. Just,
yeah, the keyboard looks nice. It's a beautiful looking machine. It's compact, powerful. You can get it new in box for $60. Like, how did this happen? How did we all miss this thing somehow?
Well, I think because it required a bi-directional cable network that didn't exist. and has no internal storage, so what are you going to do with the thing? Yeah. So it just flopped immediately.
Yeah. But yeah, it's opening a floodgate now. People are porting games to it. Like, there's a screenshot of Miner 2049 here that someone's ported, and it's exploding. There's development tools, and I was talking about in the Discord there that somehow this computer that none of us had ever heard of a month ago has more accessories available for it than anything else I have, which is bonkers.
Yeah. Some of these games were in the day. I mean, like, you know, so they were ported to the Naboo and were sent around, you know, the cable.
Oh, interesting.
But, okay. So we have one of the developers. Oh, we talked about it, I think, you know, a time or two ago, but one of the developers had a machine and still had the software and has made that available. And it is possible to get storage for this. So the development machines had drives, and there are people who have made like a compact flash adapters and things like that, so that you can connect this to something. And CPM has been ported to it. So if you want to, you can run WordStar. I tried to run WordStar and it didn't look quite right. Also, it's a 40 column screen, so there's a kind of a special version of CPM that allows you to kind of like scroll back and forth, you know, horizontally to see the whole thing. But it was pretty wild.
Well, I'm sure there'll be a lot of announcements at Naboo Fest, which will probably take place soon.
Yeah.
It needs a month, right? Because everything needs a month now. So is it like November or something?
November, yeah.
Naboon.
Naboo. November. It's got to be November. We've determined that. We're just going to work out the portmanteau.
Yeah. The development's really quick. So one thing that I tried is there's a chat room, because like once you have this serial cable, you're not any longer really limited to one directional communication. So the CPM, there's a cloud CPM that exists I think it's possible to write to like an image that you have on the other end of your serial cable, so that you can just save stuff. And this chat room, you know, anyone with a Naboo on the network can just like go into the chat room. And I, you know, so I went in there. There was one other person there. I talked to someone who was across the continent for a little bit, and then you know, on the actual 1984 machine.
Which would have been amazing in 1984 to be able to talk to somebody across the continent.
Yeah, exactly.
Super Grover in the chat says apparently MSX games are being ported to it now, which makes total sense. It's basically MSX hardware. I can imagine TI-99 games being ported to it also, because it's very close to TI-99 hardware.
Mm-hmm. Should try to port over the Infocom system so I can port Dorm to it and go, here, okay, I'll release my game on another system. I picked Naboo as the number two system. going super obscurely.
Well, if it'll run CPM, it'll run an Infocom interpreter, right?
Yeah. There definitely are some, not all, but some Infocom games on the CPM images cloud. So, yeah, I was trying to find, what was it? What's that? What's the GRU? Not GRU. GUE one. Lurking Horror.
Oh, Lurking Horror! I love that game. My goodness.
But that one's not there.
Oh.
But anyway. It is possible to emulate this. So if you, even if you don't want to get, you know, a nice looking box shipped to you, it's possible to emulate it in MAME, kind of. And also there's a standalone emulator called Marduk that's being put together. Both of them sort of start. This is the GitHub for Marduk. I think MAME can start CPM and Marduk can't quite yet, but they're both being actively developed, and so like whatever problems there are being addressed. So we'll probably hear more about this because I think Earl's got one on the way too. I want to get a Gopher client going.
Everything has to have a Gopher client now. It's the new thing. It's the old new thing.
Yep.
That's the Nabu slogan. It's the old new thing, or the new old thing, or whatever.
Right. Okay. Anyway, so that was my item of interest or news was sort of enthusiasm about the Nabu. It does feel a little bit like a cult. But
so it's like an Apple product. Okay, cool. I can get on board with that.
Exactly. Yeah. Just got to develop that air of disregard for everything not Nabu, and then you're in. You're done.
That's right. Anyone who tells you otherwise is trying to undermine you and should be cut from your life.
Right.
Exactly. Cut them out of your life.
All right. Quinn, you have the next thing.
I do. So this is much, I guess, so much like FujiNet has become the adapter to rule them all, that does all things on all computers, such to the point that soon we'll just all be using FujiNets for all of our computing needs. This thing is called the Mouster, and it is designed to do the same thing, but for mice emulation. Mm-hmm. So it's the design vision of it is a universal DE9 mouse adapter. And yes, I said DE9, nerds, fight me. I know everyone calls it the DB9, including the Mouster team calls it the DB9. That is incorrect, because in fact, B indicates the width of the shell. So B is only appropriate for the DB25. The 9-pin joystick connector that we all know is in fact the DE9. And there you go, I said it
this
now.
This is the hill on which Quinn will kill all of you. Come die on this hill, exactly. You all are.
And definitely don't listen to old shows where I'm sure I have also called it the DB9 hundreds of times, because...
But we all have to learn.
Yes. Yep. Anyway... In fact, I looked it up just before this show so that I could say it correctly, because I kind of knew we've all been saying it wrong, but I wasn't sure the exact details, so I looked it up, and DE9 is in fact correct. Anyway, what this thing is an adapter that's literally the size of a DE9 connector. It's that small. So it's just like the little 9-pin connector on one side and a USB connector on the other side, and you can plug it in allegedly to any retro computer pretty much that has that connector for its mouse, and then plug in any USB mouse, and it will just work. It's so named Mouster with the S and T capital because I guess it started as an Atari ST thing, but now it supports a bunch of other machines. So they're currently working on 2GS and Apple II 8-bit mouse support. The news here is that they've recently added Amiga support. And what's super amazing about this thing is that it's not just a mouse emulator, of which previous ones have existed. It's actually backporting hardware mouse features. So this latest development demonstrates the scroll wheel working on an Amiga, which is kind of amazing. If you think about all the things that have to exist for a scroll wheel to work that retro computers don't do, like pointer focus awareness and interacting with a scroll bar indirectly in the GUI, these are all things that retro GUIs don't do. So unfortunately, I could not find anywhere where he explains how he's doing this. The documentation on this thing is very, very light. The GitHub actually does not have the source code in it. The GitHub only has releases in it, And when you download a release, you get a zip file with the source code in it, but you can't just browse the code. And there's no documentation, as far as I can find, about how any of this works. So I would love to know how he's implemented the Amiga scroll wheel, because that is super, super cool to take a modern hardware feature and make that work on an old machine that has no knowledge that such a hardware thing might ever exist. That's fantastic. So that's the main reason I wanted to call this out. Not only is it a cool USB mouse adapter, but it's apparently soon to be universal. It will just support all machines, which I'm a big fan of anything that allows you to have a small amount of hardware and get a lot of use out of it.
Absolutely.
So if I could have one mouse, if I could have one mouse that I could just move to all of my retro computers instead of having to have 10 different mice, that would be super cool. I would love that, much like I dream of someday having one monitor for all the retro machines, which might be
given that
soon
we
to happen.
About,
yeah, like we talked about. Yeah. But anyway, so that's the Mouster. Really cool. So you can buy this thing now, and we'll link to it in the show notes. So as I say, it's open source-ish. Like, the source comes with it when you download it, but like, it's not in GitHub and taking pull requests and stuff. So I'm not sure what the source status of this thing is. It's a little bit hard to say. But anyway, that's the Mouster.
Very cool. All right. Okay. Well, Quinn, do you want to talk about the fonts?
Sure. Yeah. This was sort of a bonus item I'd throw in here because it's quick. Somewhere along the way, I stumbled onto this GitHub repo that is by far the biggest collection of retro fonts that I've ever seen. And by retro font, I mean the font that was actually used by the machine.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So there's something so nostalgic about seeing the Apple II font or seeing the original PC DOS font, right? Like, you know, when you see those little bubbles on the serifs that you're looking at an old PC, you're looking at DOS 3.3 or whatever. And so this is those fonts in a form that you can use in any modern text editing environment. So, and it's got everything. Like, we've all got our Apple II font and our PC DOS font, but this is like Acorn and Amiga and Amstrad, and all the Atari fonts are there, all the Commodore fonts are in there, Epson, Geos, like crazy, every retro thing you can think of. There's old printers in here, like the default font that was on old printers.
Oh, it does. It's got things like the FC Serif font from old Mac things. Like, it's really obscure. Yeah. Toronto, which is a font that went away for ages ago. Wow. Mm-hmm.
It's an enormous repository.
This must be
like,
ripping off a lot
this.
Of licensed things, though. Did this...
Probably.
Hey,
this is probably
download now.
Not entirely. Yeah, download now while before the CNDs start flying. This is fantastic because so if you're running an emulator, this is invaluable. Or if you just like having stuff that looks like the fonts that you loved.
Or doing artwork. A lot of times I'm trying to mock up something and I'm mm-hmm. pretending to make an old thing or whatever, and it's super handy to have fonts like this. Nice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
By the way, if you go to the end of the README on the GitHub, there's a link to see the fonts as images, so you can actually try before you download if you want.
No, I'm just taking them all, everything. But this, Oh, this is nicely implemented. Nice.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. So there's Amiga Helvetica 11.
Yeah, and the Lisa stuff and like nice. Wow.
Mm-hmm. Oh, see, look at that. It's even got the French Canadian Apple II alternate character set. That was a rare option on Apple IIs that were sold in Canada. Like, where are you going to find that online?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Very
cool.
Cool.
Yeah. So strong recommend for that, but yeah, probably download it while you can, because this feels like something, as soon as some font company finds this, it's getting CNDed for sure.
So that's why we're telling everybody about it.
Yep. That's right.
Exactly. With our giant audience.
RCR, ruiner of things we like.
If neither of the people listening are lawyers, we're good.
Yep. All right, and since we made it, and now a word from our sponsor.
It used to be that the only way you could create quality artwork was by hand. But now there's a better way. Now anyone can create high-quality graphics and illustrations quickly and easily. Because today there's a revolution taking place in graphic design and production. A revolution born of computers and laser technology, but with its roots in the tradition of quality and creativity. A revolution based on new tools, tools which free the imagination and eliminate drudgery. Introducing Adobe Illustrator 88 from Adobe Systems.
When things start changing right before your eyes, when shapes just seem to appear out of nowhere, when the whole world seems transformed, you've been Tetrisized. Nintendo introduces Tetris. It will mesmerize you. Tetris challenges the mind and puzzles the imagination. No other game can stack up to Tetris. Nintendo, now you're playing with power.
We've been in the business of producing firsts in equipment, facilities, and procedures for some time. Sabre, the ultimate in a jet age reservation system, is another American Airlines first. Its speed and accuracy make it easier for you to use American Airlines and for us to maintain the highest quality of service for our passengers. The next time you're in one of our ticket offices or call reservations, listen to that light little clicking sound. It's Sabre, working away accurately and quickly for you.
And we're back. So the host's retro computing gift idea this time is the MO110 triple mode version keyboard by Vortex Keyboard. This, as I understand it, is a keyboard that looks like it's basically the keyboard for the old Macs, right? The Mac Plus kind of era.
Yeah, like the toaster Mac time.
Yeah, more or less. It's actually more colorful than the original ones.
It
has gray keys around it. Yeah, yeah, beige and darker beige. But they look really nice. They're modern keyboards for modern computers. They have the triple mode refers to modes of connection. I think there's like a Bluetooth and a USB-C and something else.
And Wi-Fi, I think, weirdly. Like other thing that you wouldn't suspect, not RF, something like that.
Yeah, 2.4 gigahertz Wi-Fi, I guess. But so it's not for your old machine, although I suppose maybe you could rig up something so you run it through a Wombat to get to a Mac. But it looks very nice. If you wanted to, like, hook this up to your iPhone and take it to the, you know, the Starbucks or whatever, I think it would be pretty cool.
Clack, 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 clack.
Yeah.
Because you get your choice of, if I recall, choice of a bunch of key switches. You can, like, you're, when you pre order, you pick, okay, I want the cherry red or whatever.
Yeah, it looks like there are a fair number of options. And also, if if the MO110 is not your preferred keyboard, there are others as well. So you can have a PC Junior keyboard, and there are various other options at this keyboard store. So
that's pretty cool, actually. Yeah. All the different options.
Yeah, it's cool because it's not just like a clacky keyboard, as the cool kids say today. Like, you can get one that very much harkens back to the style of a PC keyboard or old Mac keyboard. Or it's retro both in its sound and feel and also in its aesthetics. They're cool.
It's fairly minimal in the number of keys that it has, right? So does it have, like, the stuff you need for modern stuff? Like, does it have a Windows key or an open Apple key or whatever?
You can double Bucky.
That's right. Yeah.
Call back.
I don't know. You have... Somewhere it does say the number of keys, and I think there are two options, but...
Because, like, I always love the idea of using, like, my 2GS keyboard or my 2C+ keyboard on a modern machine, like Charles Mangan used to sell those adapters for doing that. But then it's like, well, I don't have a Windows key or whatever, so I can't do most of the stuff in a modern environment that you would need to.
Yeah.
But if these do have the necessary keys, it could be a good compromise, because it would feel retro, but still... usable.
Most serious clacky keyboard aficionados say you shouldn't do anything but open the terminal. And why did you need those other things anyway? You're a poser.
Yeah. Fair. If you're doing anything but booting into console safe mode, then you're not a real computer user.
Right.
It's a no true Scotsman argument of all retro things.
Exactly.
$144 is what I see as the list price for this.
Did you switch between the two color variants, because it's pretty funny to see. So you can click on those. So you can see how there's the beige color variant at the top there. And clicking the other one, ooh, can you see the difference? Can you tell? Can you tell? Because I can't tell.
I cannot.
It's supposedly two different color variants, but I honestly can't tell them apart. Like, there must be some key that is slightly different, but I don't know what.
That's sort of amazing.
Right. I think the keys themselves maybe are
darker. It's not a color variant. It's color / variant. It's adding a couple of other keys. Oh, yeah, right. It's adding control key or something.
Yeah, the top one has the big L-shaped PC-style enter key, and the other one has a more rectangular one.
Okay, I thought it was literally a color variant, because I kept going back and forth, going like, these colors are the same, man.
That is sort of the 80s in a nutshell, though. It's like, no, this is a completely different beige.
This one is cool.
Yeah.
All right.
This is snow beige.
Okay, so when you're done with your keyboards, I wanted to give you an update on an old gift idea. So back in December 2012...
Oh, my goodness.
I don't know who was responsible for this, but Carrington, you and Earl were on.
It was Earl. It was David. He's not here.
Oh, yeah.
It's totally David.
Well, it says Earl.
Ah, it was Earl.
Actually,
pretending to be
it's
David.
Actually attributed this time.
All I know is it wasn't me.
Yeah. But so he suggested a retrophone handset for cell phones, something like this. This is a sort of a modern one. This one is still for sale, a VTech LS916 retro handset, which is basically just a handset that ends in a mini phono plug, or whatever you call those, that like a headphone plug. And so I got one, and it does seem to fit. So we were wondering about whether the size was going to be.
We were. Look at that.
So anyway.
And it appears to be plugged into a lightning adapter for your phone.
Yep. So I'm all set.
Okay.
That's as far as I got. But I'm kind of.
So I believe, Paul, you and Quinn have to swap your names on the video here. But you are now Insufferable Hipster.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. I liked it though.
Well, the next question that you can now answer is, will it work over modern cell phone or even landline voice?
Yeah.
Because as we all know, modern voice systems, even if you get a landline, it's actually voice over IP. All of it is now VoIP. And we have theorized that the dynamic range and compression of VoIP is probably both too poor for modems to actually work. But we don't know for sure.
The belief is that this is a 300 baud modem that it's sitting in. So probably, there's a chance that'll work.
Yeah, that'll work over a string and cup.
Yeah, you're never going to get 14.4 to work with all the crazy handshaking and compression and stuff. But 300 baud, yeah, maybe. It didn't use that much of a frequency range, and the spacing between the ranges is sufficiently large that the error might not overwhelm it. So
yeah.
Chris in the chat says you can practically sing 300 baud over the phone.
Yeah.
I was thinking you could have a delay line and just hit it with a hammer and that would work. Close enough.
That would be pretty fun to be able to sing to a fax machine or something. And
play it on
your
flute,
goals
maybe?
Are so weird. That's the worst dating sim
but I respect
ever.
Them. Special skills. I can whistle 300 baud.
I romanced a fax machine.
Yep. Made it print a heart.
If you sang to it and it printed out a little heart, I'd be very impressed.
Yeah. All right. Okay. So now that we are through the gift idea portion of the show, we can move on to eBay auctions. And Carrington has the first of these.
I do indeed, and this came from somebody said a couple episodes ago, and also in thinking about the Naboo and this idea of something that has no internal storage. And I have changed my mind over the last few years in picking computers that I'd want to have and such, and it was always the case that with something like a Mac SE or an SE30 or something from that vintage, I would always kind of turn up my nose at the ones that were the dual floppy, like the low-end one. Why would you want a dual floppy computer? That's ridiculous. Floppies are so slow, so awful. But the reality is, I'm not going to want to use the original hard drive that came with any of these things. I'm not going to trust it. It's slow. The first thing I'm going to be doing is replacing that storage with something else, with a Blue SCSI, with a whatever, many of which are much easier to install as external things. So the reality is nowadays, if I was going searching for a Mac SE, say, like this, for less than half the cost of all the ones on eBay with a hard drive, I would much prefer the one with the dual floppy, and then I then attach a cheap Blue SCSI to it. And now I've got a computer with two floppies and much faster storage, which and I've saved $250 over what the purchase price would be normally. So it's a weird thing that's changed over the life of this podcast, that I never would have considered that the desirable models of old computers were the ones without hard drives. I'm like, why do I want that hard drive anyway? I'm immediately going to replace it. Give me one that has two floppies or something. That it saves me money, and it's, why not? It's easier to get. It's easier to work on. And so that's my pick this time. I have picked a Macintosh SE. Mm-hmm. It's $140. All the competitive ones, AB right now, if you get one with internal hard drive, it'll be $350 to $600 for essentially the same computer. So this is my new recommendation. Snub the old hard drives. Go the Naboo style. The storage is for suckers.
It's a good point. Like plus the floppies are more likely to still be working than an old hard drive is. Like some 50-year-old Seagate drive is probably not working, but an old floppy drive still is.
Or not working such that I would trust it, right? And set up, like, why would I bother? The first thing I'm going to do is replace that with something that uses solid-state storage of some sort. And the floppies for these are also readily and cheaply available and easy to change. So this is a more useful computer. I'd rather have the two floppies to copy between and fast solid-state storage that I can, like, say, unplug my SD card and move it to something else. Like, there's just so many other options. So it's a weird 180 of what I consider the desirability of computers that era. So go Naboo.
Plus our usage patterns have changed, right? Like on my 2GS, the hard drive was essential because I was using it for word processing and school assignments and stuff. But now when I fire up my 2GS, I just want to play a couple games and watch some FTA demos. And for that, the floppy drive is just as good or better. Right. So the old 40 megabyte hard drive that I have on that thing is frankly useless because I'm not interested in doing big data storage things. I just want to play with the computer for 10 minutes and you don't need a hard
drive. Big data killed your paw. So yeah, so totally, like something like this with a floppy emu, I'm happy, and it's half the cost of alternatives.
Yeah, and actually also a lot quieter.
Yeah, right? That's true. Yes, yeah. Well, the fans in these things are also super noisy, but they're also easily replaceable. But something I would rather spend the same money and buy an old computer like this with no hard drive that's been recapped than the same cost for a non-recapped one with a hard drive. Like one is going to be much more reliable, and it seems like a no-brainer. And yet I always, for years, I would like, oh, why get the dual floppy one? That's the bad one. No, now it's the good one.
Plus now you have twice the chances that the floppy drive is working.
Yeah.
If one of them is dead, like, because the second one probably got very little use. So you can... it's probably less worn out, so you can just swap them if the primary one doesn't work.
So anyway, that's my choice. $140. Good idea. Save yourself some money and start looking at the dual floppy versions of old computers, or single floppy versions, or whatever.
Excellent. All right, let's see. I have a few. Let's
Surprise.
See what I want to talk about. yeah. So of course, largely what I ended up with is just things making jokes.
But okay, that's fine.
That's the way it goes. So everybody already knows the joke for this one. Make your app 2+ respectful again.
Right.
It's an F key. anyway. This is an auction for Apple III drive badges, which are aspirational. They are all drive four.
Ooh.
that's amazing. Drive four.
Yeah.
Wow. How would you have four? Wow.
That's so much data.
Yeah, they're official Apple products too. So
yeah.
Did these come with the Apple III, or if you bought an extra drive, did it come with 1 through 4 or something?
I don't actually, that's a good question. I don't know how these originally came, but you got these with drives, but of course I was never in the Apple III market at the time. So
yeah, like when you bought a Disk 2, it came with both labels. It came with a Drive 1 and a Drive 2 label, so you could stick the appropriate one on. But it's funny that they're all Drive 4 because, of course, that's the ones that survived because nobody had four drives.
Lots of new old stock of that one.
Yeah. They also had, like, if you got CPM or like a soft card. You know, it would come with an A and a B sticker for your you know, putting on your drives for CPM designations. But okay, next thing is somewhat relevant, I guess, to the year. It is a 1980s American Airlines Sabre System World Calculator alarm clock works. Yep. So it is in the sort of form factor of a flip phone. So I don't know how old it is.
You said this was an alarm clock?
Yeah, it's like a time zone calculator and alarm clock.
Okay.
And I guess also, yeah.
Time to get a new career.
Yep. So it's got a London, a Paris, a Moscow, you know, Tokyo.
Everybody's talking about pop music. What are we doing?
The trick is that it won't tell you the time. Someone across the desk from you will tell you the time after you ask a bunch of questions about what your time zone is.
I have some times with a one in them. Would that work for you? Come on, please just turn it around.
Would you say you're in the Florida time zone, or would you say you're more of a mountain time zone?
Yeah, it's kind of cool, though. It's $10 by it now. I'm not overly tempted, but, you know, if whatever. It's kind of cool anyway. You know, so we last time we talked about the Lisa becoming 40 and getting its operating system source published by the Computer History Museum. This is a Lisa 2, and comes with a printer and the mouse. It's missing a key.
Missing a key, but the printer's beautiful.
Yeah.
I've never seen that printer. Is that what is that?
It's an Olympia.
Something. Oh, it's an Olympia. Okay.
Yeah. So it doesn't, it's not Apple branded.
Official. Yeah. Okay. It's nice to have a printer though.
Yeah.
Olympia, so maybe indeed. A daisy wheel or something, but cool. Nice.
Yeah. And it has the Lisa 1 mouse, which is much, much treasured. It has one bid. It is $600. And honestly, I think that's if it ended there, that would be good for this. You know, so it's dumb, but that mouse added a lot of value to this. It's, you know, whatever. It's a bad mouse. It doesn't work well.
But it's the mouse.
But it is the mouse.
The one mouse.
What is the key that it's missing?
Yeah, that missing key is really a deal breaker for
me. And is there a $200 auction for that key by the same person?
Yeah, right.
I think it's the slash question mark key that's missing. Is that
I think so. It does say in the description. Slash question mark.
That's disappointing. That might be very hard to get, unless that keyboard happens to be the same as early Macs or something.
Yeah. Though there may actually be more Lisa keyboards out there than there are Lisas. I know I have two more Lisa keyboards than I have Lisas.
Oh, good.
All right, fair enough.
But, but actually, yeah, they're also kind of annoying as keyboards because they have they within them they have I think it's foam that deteriorates.
Oh, right. You've talked about that
that's
before.
The worst.
Yeah, that is the worst.
Yeah. That foam.
But who knows what the you know, sort of condition of this keyboard is apart from the missing key, but it actually looks really nice. It is a model that had a battery in that corner and it had leaked a bit and the batteries are out. So it is not getting worse.
How bad did they get?
Tried to turn it on. Yeah, exactly. That's the thing. You can see a little bit of corrosion on the ports, which isn't a good sign, but it's not, it also isn't dramatic looking, so maybe it's okay.
Is there a board under that, or is this the, because the damage would be minor based on where that battery is, right? Unless there's a horizontal motherboard underneath that or something.
And there is.
Oh.
It looks like this. So
So right there is where our problem is.
Ooh, yeah. That's not good.
Yeah. However, the motherboard is, I think it's actually, it doesn't have much on it. It has connectors. You know, it's like a dock, basically.
Really just a back plane.
Yeah. And a couple of years ago, there was a, 5 years ago, there was a remake of this motherboard. So for people who have exactly this problem.
Oh, that's nice. Look at that.
Yeah. So it's just a drop-in replacement. I have seen no evidence that you can buy one, if you're living in a time that's after 2018, but they do sort of in principle exist, and maybe they're still acquirable in some way, or you could convince someone to build another one. So if you wind up with this or a Lisa like this
and a time machine
that has a corrosion. Well, right. Oh, yeah,
and,
that
and
also
a, and a question mark key. Becoming a very expensive item you've picked here.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I think if the first bidder gets this, they have done all right. I don't know if it'll continue to get bid up. It actually hasn't been listed for very long. So.
Oh, yeah, there's still 6 days left. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. I want the printer more than the computer.
It could be. So I have one of these with the power supply flaked out. I'm pretty sure. I mean, it has a similar kind of like, it behaves like a stone behavior, you know, no matter which switch you flip. But I believe probably that's the power supply having lost a capacitor or something like that. And so I'm hoping that if I just fix it, that will bring it back to life. Because I have seen my Lisa boot before. I have used a floppy emu in it, and I have a X profile, you know, hard drive simulator in it. And it's pretty cool. It's super slow. but they're harder, getting kind of hard to get. Okay, let's see. I have, I think, two more that I will talk about. They are both Apple related. I apologize. So this one is, it says mystery vintage Apple III computer test fixture ? And what it seems to be is, it's an Apple III that's missing its badges, and it's, you know, it's on the back of it. It's missing the disk drive, the internal disk drive. Is that correct? I don't know. It's missing the analog board. That's what it's missing. So it's missing a part of the disk drive. The mechanism is there, but the analog board isn't. So you'd have to replace that if you were trying to get it working. It has an Apple asset type tag on it, that makes it appear like it was actually probably some kind of internal, maybe test, machine. And it has also, there's a couple of telltale things about this that make it, I think, relatively clear that it is a 3 Plus, which is a rare variant of the Apple III. So it has the interlacing switch in it, and still has batteries in it for some reason, which connect to the clock.
I love that somebody makes an eBay auction for old computers and like just shows a photo of the batteries, like, buy this computer or the computer gets it. Look, I'm just going to leave those in there.
Right. Yeah, that's great. But the other sort of tip off, well, there's a couple of tips off here. The floppy drive port is, I guess, a DB connector. So that shows that it's a 3 Plus and not a 3. And also the keyboard, if you look at it, it's like you're looking at a 2E keyboard. It does not look like a 3. So even though the badge is missing, it's, I think, one of the desirable ones. And it has gotten over $600 already. 13 people have realized what they're looking at.
How difficult would that analog board be to replace? Because that would seem to be the deal breaker as far as doing anything with it, right?
I think it's not hard. So I'm pretty sure that's going to be, like, even if you got an Apple III external drive, that'll have that in it. So
is it the same drive as the Apple II? Like, could you put it a disk II analog board in it?
That is a good question. It is physically, like, mechanically, it's basically the same as the Apple II drive. Yeah. And they do have different analog boards, but it is also possible to use a disk II on an Apple III, I'm pretty sure. So I think the answer isn't super straightforward. It must be missing something like chainability or something like that if you use the disk II.
Is it the case, though, that an Apple III requires a physical floppy to boot, even if you have like a floppy emu or something?
Right. Yeah, it does. Something disk drive like has to be plugged into the internal port. I mean, so on mine, I've bypassed the physical drive by plugging a, whatever you call it, SD floppy thing into the external port, or a W drive, I guess.
Oh, so it is possible to do that. So you could boot this machine without a floppy drive at all if you got one of those SD floppies or something. Okay, cool. So that would be still a good purchase then.
Yeah.
Even if you can't fix the floppy drive, because you're not going to probably use the physical floppy drive anyway, unless you have to.
Right. Yeah. It's definitely much easier if you're trying to, you know, work on stuff that that boots. So like the last summer I was trying to write something that you had to boot, and there's, you know, I didn't want to keep writing to a physical floppy. Only one other thing I was going to mention. This is the Bandai Pippin World Keyboard and Motorola Modem.
Oh, goodness. So I didn't know this was a thing.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So you may not have known the Pippin was a thing. I mean, you probably did. You personally probably did.
The Pippin, sure, yes.
But many probably did not. You know, it's like the Mac entry into the game console world.
Hugely successful.
Yes. Apple's only ever attempt at a game console, which, yeah, not many people probably know about.
Yeah. And I'm not sure. They may have been on Japan only. I'm not certain about that, but they're definitely not. They're not easy to find. And if you have one of those incredibly rare things, here's an incredibly rarer thing for your incredibly rare thing, which is it's a modem and a keyboard that you can connect to your Pippin, the Pippin At World keyboard.
At World. So at first I thought that was what was their Apple's online thing? E-World. But no,
there was an E-World. Yeah.
There was an E-World.
Yeah, which I liked the aesthetic of very, very much when I was an E-World member. But At World, I don't know.
Yeah.
Probably just the name of this thing because it has a modem.
Yeah, and my guess is it's actually, you know, it's not a service so much as the name of the thing.
I suppose this makes sense because the Pippin was just a Power Mac, right? Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think like Tony Diaz brought one to Kansas Fest a couple of times, and he had managed to get it to boot straight up like Mac OS 7 or whatever. He had to like do some chicanery to get it to just boot and thus prove to the world that it was in fact just a Mac in a box, but it was possible to do that.
And you know, it's funny thinking about the glory that was Mac gaming around that time. It does seem like a weird choice for a console platform.
But yeah, it was. That must have been like a Scully or one of those terrible CEO time period when they were just trying to build everything for everybody.
There was I don't know if we talked about it at the time, but a couple years ago, back in, I think maybe even last, I don't know, 2021, 2020, something like that. All the recent years roll together. There was an April Fool's parody online. One of the few that I actually quite liked where they announced, Bandai announced the Pippin Classic, which was like one of those built-in retro things that's smaller that would contain all the things and like a couple of new titles that they had developed and stuff. And I'm like, wow, deep cut, dudes. Nice. So
I appreciate that. There's probably 50 people in the world that got that joke.
Yeah.
But so worth it.
Yeah. Is that it? Are we done with eBay? I think we might be.
We're done with you, eBay.
Okay. All right. So I guess we can move on to closing discussions. And Carrington, do you have any words to add?
Nope. Somebody in the comments, Will, somebody said the back of my image here doesn't look very minimalist anymore because I have a chair. I don't know what to tell you, dude. I've branched out. Look at me with my couch and my chair and my record player and my nothing else.
It almost looks like somebody lives there now.
Yep. I don't quite look almost robbed.
Yeah, exactly.
But nope, no news.
Yep. All right. As for me, I already sort of talked about the Nabu news, and that was sort of my main news. I expect I'll keep working on that. It's been pretty fun. Quinn, any closing notes?
I think I mentioned on the previous episode that I have become an insufferable hipster and have acquired a turntable and a tube preamp for no reason other than, I don't know, just feeling nostalgic about things that are offline. Like I like the idea of just listening to music when you're not connected to anything. And the older I get, the more important that kind of stuff gets to me. And so the turntable has arrived and I've set it up and everything. And it's honestly like I want to punch myself every time I talk about it, but I do really love it. There's something about the physical experience of a record that it forces you to be present. And there's something that I really appreciate that nowadays. Like you can't listen to a record while you're cleaning house or while you're writing email or whatever, because, you know, there's such a physical process involved and it only sounds good unless you're sitting right in front of it and you don't have Bluetooth headphones on that you can walk around with.
Plus you only get like 18 minutes aside or whatever.
Yeah.
So where are you going to go? Right.
Yeah, and it's like three or four songs, so you have to be there. So you basically have to sit on the sofa in front of the two speakers right in the sweet spot and listen to that record and not do anything else.
But I tell you, though, I'll lay on my couch with like headphones on, listening to my record player, holding the record, like just kind of – it's such a great experience. I feel more zen than I do any other time. Just there's – oh, it's great.
It really is. I'd forgotten how good an experience that is, looking at the liner notes and like – like I was, I got this Cyndi Lauper album, and like one of the songs was like written by Michael Jackson, and it's like, how would you ever know that? Like without reading the liner notes while you listen to this song, and and there actually is a retro connection to the show here. One of the albums, here in town, there's a really great little record store, and one of the things that I found there the other day was the original Pac-Man Fever album, and so we all remember that song, which was a big hit, but it. What I didn't realize is that that song is on an album with a whole bunch of 80s video game themed songs. There's a Centipede song and a Donkey Kong song and weirdly a Exidy Mousetrap song.
And a Frogger
song,
one. And, yep.
The Frogger one. The Frogger, they're not all great pieces of music, mind you, but the Frogger one's really bad. It's half of a chorus and they just say it over and over for 3.5 minutes. But the Defender song, though, is what the one that caught me off guard. So it's like track one on side B, and it's really good. It's like this sort of wistful, like melancholy thing about he's this guy out a billion miles from home defending the universe, and no one's ever going to know the sacrifice that he's, you know, going to die to save humanity. It's this like sort of weirdly beautiful space opera that I had never heard. And so that's the kind of stuff that you get with a record player that you wouldn't get just digging through MP3s or whatever. That album is really fun. So that's been happening. Otherwise, the other retro news is that I think I'm in the next couple of weeks going to go out to my dad's and actually pick up all of my retro computers that have been sitting in his basement. Yeah, I don't yet have a full place to set them up here, but I got to get them at least physically here. So
we've been talking about those basement computers for so many years on this show.
Yeah, so long that we've been talking about it that it was my mom's magical basement that had all these computers in it, and now it's just my dad's because the story has outlived my mom. So now it's just my dad's. But there's at least an Apple II Plus, a 2GS, a Commodore 64, and a Mac 660. So I'm not sure what else might be there. I've forgotten everything that's all down there. But
the 660, that's exciting.
Yeah,
that was an unbelievably good computer.
Yeah, such a good computer.
Isn't that the one that came with a like 660 AV option as well, and a CD one maybe?
Yeah, the AV was that was the one that I had. It did crazy stunts, like you could overlay live video like with variable opacity on top of your desktop, or just like display live television in a window, like just crazy. Like it emulated a modem entirely with the DSP chip, so. It had this thing called the GeoPort, so you didn't have a modem. It would emulate the modem directly with the DSP. And so as new modem standards came out, you didn't have to buy a new modem. Like when, you know, 56, 58, whatever the last one was that was the fastest, when that standard came out, you just installed a software patch, and now it could do that too. It was just crazy great ideas like that.
I never knew what the GeoPort was. I mean, I have one, but I didn't read the box.
Yeah, it's an adapter that connects the phone line to the DSP chip inside.
Okay.
Is what it does. So that's all it's doing is it's giving the DSP a way to talk to the phone line so that it can bit bang out modem signals, basically, which is super neat.
Yeah.
And it's that kind of thing. Anyway, so all of that is hopefully going to be arriving at my house before too long, and then I'll be able to hopefully have some fun playing with that stuff.
Excellent. Yeah. Good luck to all of us finding the time.
That's part of it is if I don't get the stuff here, I'm never going to do anything. So part of it is just having it physically here also to get it out of my dad's way because it's been filling up his basement for decades. But to get it out of his way. And then once it's here, then I can start playing with it a little at a time. Got to get over that initial hump at least.
Put it sort of in between you and things you need to do.
So put it in front of the fridge and ensure that I do something with it.
All right. Excellent. I guess that's it. So That's it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can find lo-fi episodes of the episodes and more via Gopher at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss the show on the forums at forum.vcfed.org/index.php?retro-podcast-discussion.81. You can follow RCR on Mastodon at podcasts.social@rcrpodcast. Join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/rcrpodcast. Send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbackreviews.com. Please write a review on iTunes if you wish. And until next time,
retro compute.
Yeah. I give it a B+.
Gotta get myself.